This is Fresh Air. Writer Craig Lucas and director Norman Renee are waiting to see if their Broadway play Prelude to a Kiss will win the two Tonys it's nominated for. The play just won an Obie for Best New American Play. Lucas and Renee are also waiting to see how their new movie will do in theaters. The film, Longtime Companion, follows a circle of gay friends through the 1980s. The story begins in 1981, on the day the New York Times published its first story about a cancer that was striking gay men. By the time the film ends, AIDS has killed several of the men and changed the lives of the survivors. Longtime Companion was developed for Public TV's American Playhouse. I asked Renee and Lucas if it was difficult to find funding for a film about AIDS. Norman Renee answered first.
Pretty much. I think that there were some companies, when you simply mentioned that you had a project about AIDS, they said, I'm sure it's great. I don't even want to hear about it. We're not interested.
Yeah, why not? What were the reasons you got for that?
Well, the classic reason is that historically, movies about gay people have not made money, and movie companies are in the business of making money. And I think that disease movies, likewise, have primarily been the domain of television. And they're very skeptical about anything that is not uplifting or...
Formulaic.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that no one really wanted to take a financial risk on that. In terms of the homophobia in Hollywood, which is often talked about, I think it's very difficult to say anything about that because no one was overtly homophobic in their response to the script.
Mm-hmm.
But we did get one response from one major distribution company that American Playhouse went to in search for funds for the picture. And this particular company said, thank you for sending the script to Longtime Companion. We are concentrating, and I as an individual, the man who runs the studio, is also very much involved in charitable organizations. And he said, I am concentrating all of my efforts into educating the American public to realizing that AIDS is not a gay disease. I am still waiting to see the movie this man makes about IV drug users with AIDS.
Now you got money, I think, from the National Endowment for the Arts because the NEA gives some money to American Playhouse.
Yes.
Did you have to worry about the no homoeroticism clause?
This movie was made and practically finished its post-production by the time the Helms Amendment came in.
So was it not a concern, or?
It really wasn't. I think we were probably, I remember we were editing the film mm-hmm. when this whole thing sort of blew up and
at the courtroom.
I mean, I don't know what happens. Lindsay Law, the executive producer, said the movie opens in Washington this weekend, and I guess all the congressmen will get to see it and make up their own minds.
I would be very, very interested to see. I'm hoping, in a way, it will continue to push more buttons. The NEA is obviously endangered, and the more public attention that can be thrown on this Helms Amendment, the better. Joseph Papp stood up the other night at the Obie Awards and said what I've been feeling all along, which is that the controversy over the Mapplethorpe exhibit and the Helms Amendment boils down to one thing and one thing only, and that's gay and lesbian bashing. It is homophobia. It's nothing else. And I hope the lid can be blown off it and it will stimulate more debate.
The story in Longtime Companion starts with all the characters in the movie reading the New York Times and finding out about this form of cancer that seems to be afflicting gay men. Is that how you first found out about AIDS, through the New York Times? Or did you read about it first in the gay press?
I think I found about it first from Craig, who had read it in the New York Times.
The first article to appear, I think, may have been in a medical journal like The Lancet. But the wire services picked it up in July of 81, and there it was on page A20 of the Times. You know, it went through Manhattan seismically, like a tremor.
What effect did it have on you when you read it?
Well, if somebody says to you, "Now listen, you know, everything you've been doing for the last 10 years of your life looks like it could kill you," you hope that that's not true, and it seemed so unbelievable that really there could be a viral agent that was passing through the gay community. So much of it was mysterious. and hard to process mentally. I was panicked. I remember that day, and I called Norman as well as several other friends and said, look at this. This is really wild. And then I think I slowly put it out of my mind. I looked for ways to deny it and pretend that it hadn't appeared.
When did it first actually hit you personally? I mean, have a personal impact on your life?
I had a friend, not a close friend, get sick within the first year, probably late fall of 81 or maybe the beginning of 82, well-known stage director. And he really went into a steep and quick decline. Then the summer of 82, one of my very first lovers died of AIDS.
What were some of the issues you both had to think through in the writing and in the direction in terms of putting the story of AIDS' impact on a circle of gay friends on screen? Did you think of this as, you know, something for the mainstream audience, or the things that you felt you wanted to either tone down or introduce?
Well, I think I understand your question. The primary thing, I think, for both Craig, myself, and for the actors, was that we wanted to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And we're more concerned with that than necessarily what audience it would reach.
Mm-hmm.
It forced us to focus on the things that we thought were important and to let go of the things that we didn't feel were important.
Such as?
Well, for me, the movie was about people who, by circumstance, had a particular sexual preference. And the main focus of the movie was on the relationships between these people, not their sexuality. And I didn't want to cloud the issue by showing a lot of sort of graphic sexual scenes that didn't really contribute to the tone of the movie. But it was very important to me to show the intimacy between the characters. And to develop relationships and how those relationships grew or fell apart or were strengthened because of what happened in the course of the movie. It also seemed important to me not to turn the movie into a melodrama. It seemed to me that the fact of AIDS, the fact of people dying, losing friends, losing lovers, carried an enormous amount of weight with it. And I wanted to be careful not to indulge or make pathetic the movie. I don't know, Craig, do you want to...
Well, there's just so many things we could have gone into. And a lot of ground has been covered, perhaps not as thoroughly as it needs to be, but the very, very infrequent feature film that has focused on gay characters has almost to a one been about fringe characters. And they have focused largely on backroom bar sex, baths, late night, leather bar kind of behavior. All of which, of course, goes on, and I've certainly seen my share of all of that, but it seemed that the only thing that movies was willing to show was that element of gay life. And I know just as many straight people who've been to Hellfire and clubs like that, and I've been to those places myself and seen those things, and no movies ever seem to be made about heterosexual relationships from that angle. So I didn't see any need to contribute to the pervasive national notion that gay people stay up all night, have sex with hundreds of people, and wear dresses or leather or are hairdressers or in some way exotic, extravagant, overly anything, overly witty, overly sad, overly lonely. there are tens of millions of gay people in this country, and most of them get up in the morning and go to a regular job. Gay people are not all one thing any more than brown-haired people are all one thing. But I do know that a friend of mine who has AIDS went to the doctor the other day to see his doctor, and he's sitting there in the waiting room, and the other people in the waiting room were seven other middle-class gay men in their suits, their gray suits with their attaché cases. And that's a world that I had never seen on film, and it's the world that I see day in and day out. And it was very, very important to me to let the world at large know that being gay is not in and of itself extraordinary, that what has been extraordinary about these last 10 years are that gay people have banded together and created some kind of a community to protect and fight for themselves, and that they have nothing to be ashamed of. So, yes, we we talked about this a lot, and it was terribly, terribly important that we bring it home.
You've both been collaborating for, well, at least 10 years. And I think you've worked together on every project that you've done. How did you start working together?
A mutual friend gave me the first act of Craig's first play. And I was then running a small theater company called The Production Company. Uh-huh. And I read the play and really liked it. And I called Craig and I said, if you'll finish this, I'll produce it. And he did, and I did.
I wonder if success threatens to break up the partnership in the sense that now between Prelude to a Kiss and Longtime Companion are both getting well-known, and it's conceivable one of you would be offered something without the other. Have you talked that through yet?
Well, that's happened. That circumstance has come up for us long before our current and, I'm sure, momentary notoriety. Many, many years ago, I had a play that I wanted to do at an off-Broadway theater, and they offered me a production on the condition that I use another director.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I decided that was not good for me, for the play. It didn't come just out of loyalty. I found that my work has grown and deepened, and I always learn something by working with Norman, and I see no reason to not do that.
Let me ask you about one of your early collaborations. This was, I think, back in 1980, and I'm thinking of Marry Me a Little, and it's a review of Stephen Sondheim's songs that were cut from shows that he'd written, and Craig, you had written a story around the songs, you know, as kind of connective tissue for them, a framing story. Craig, can you tell me how the review came to be, how you got Sondheim's permission? I think you were singing in the chorus of Sweeney Todd at the time you asked him to do this.
Sweeney Todd had just closed on Broadway, and I was still a performer then. I was in the chorus of that show. Steve had read my first play, or the first act of that first play that Norman agreed to produce if I would finish it. While I was redoing that work, Norman had a friend who wanted to do a late-night cabaret at the production company, which used to do that on the same set of the plays that they did at 8 o'clock. At 11 o'clock or 10:30 or something, they would do some kind of a review, putting together, stringing songs together. And Norman asked me if I would write something. I said, no, I couldn't write two things at the same time, but I would certainly... I was game to, and I would write Sondheim and ask him if there was any chance we could get our hands on some of his trunk songs that had been cut from his shows or had been written for other special material that had never been published. To my complete amazement, he said, sure, I think it's a terrible idea, but go ahead and do it. And he pretty much opened up his coffers, and we went through the songs together and pulled out about maybe 30, 35 of them, went through them, culled them down to, I think, 17. And then Norman and I together came up with the idea of framing them in two separate apartments, people alone on a Saturday night. But by joining the two apartments, merging them into one, you would see the people in the same space, though they were literally living over top of one another.
Craig, you're one of the two singers in the original production and in the cast recording.
You would bring that up.
Yeah, I brought the record too.
No!
I like your singing a lot, and I want to play something from it. What would you rather hear, Happily Ever After or Who Could Be Blue?
Oh, Who Could Be Blue. I love that song.
Okay.
Who could be blue, knowing there's you somewhere nearby, when anyone feels your glow, their low has to get high. So how could I allow anything now to dim my eye with you? Long as there's you with me,
have you you given up singing? I mean, do you act or sing in anything anymore?
I perform nightly in my shower, and that's the full extent of it. I sang at a friend's memorial this last year, and other than that, no, I don't sing anymore. I'd love to be invited. You know, I occasionally fantasize, gee, if someone would
beg
ask
you.
Me, I would, what'd you say?
Beg you.
Beg me. I would sing, you know, at a one-shot sort of deal. I wouldn't want to have to do 8 shows a week. That's too hard.
Don't you miss it, though?
No.
You don't?
No.
Why not?
I was never very happy as a performer, to be perfectly honest. The only aspect of performing that I enjoyed was the singing. I am not comfortable in front of people. A great deal of the performer's psyche, I think, has to do with coming alive in front of people. And I'm actually much more comfortable hiding, watching, listening. I think that's why I'm a better writer than I am a performer. It's very, very painful for me, honestly.
The Tony Awards are coming up on Sunday. You're up for 2 for Prelude to a Kiss. Are you already, like, writing speeches in case you get the awards?
I actually got a letter at the theater yesterday from the producer of the Tony Awards encouraging me to not thank lots of people, to be, quote-unquote, entertaining. So I'm thinking of mooning him at the Tonys. And past that, no, I'm trying to not hope for much.
Well, good luck to you. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Writer Craig Lucas and director Norman Rene, they collaborated on the play Prelude to a Kiss and the new movie, Longtime Companion.